Yeah, we got everybody. I'd like to call House Finance Meeting to order. We have a quorum today with Representative Grusdorf, Martin, Mulder, myself, Terrio, Kelly, and Davis. Today we're going to have a hearing on the RIP program. Here's some information from Anna Lee and whoever else she wants to have describe kind of how it's going. Maybe give us a little bit of history, and we've also got some folks signed up. We have had concerns expressed. A number of us have been getting letters about the program, so we thought we'd get an overview, let the department explain what's going on and some of their policies, and then ask some questions and have some public testimony as well as to people concerns or problems that they have, so that we can get some questions answered and see if there's anything that needs to be done or whatever. There's no specific intent. There's no bill in front of us. It's more of an informational session to try and work some of this stuff out and have a public hearing. So with that, Anna Lee, if you'd like, whoever you would like to start, if it's you or anyone else you want to have join us, if you could start off and give your name for the record.
For the record, my name is Anna Lee McConnell, Director of the Governor's Office of Management and Budget. First of all, I think this probably is a helpful time to have an update on RIP for a number of reasons, one of which is that no matter how many times, you know, we talk about and get information out to people, there are always folks who haven't heard it. So to the extent that there are employees or who hear this, or those of you who weren't involved in some of the earlier discussions, I'm happy to go through it. And we would be happy to provide periodic updates for you as we go through the session. A little bit of background that I'd like to reiterate, not so much necessarily for those of you at this table, but because of others who may be online or here in the room, about the bill. When the idea of a RIP was first proposed a couple of years ago as one of the tools for downsizing, there were a lot of concerns raised by members of the legislature who felt that some of the prior RIPs had not achieved as much savings as had been anticipated. And I wasn't here during that period, but I understand from afterwards that there were some real differences of opinion about whether there were savings, and if so, how much savings, or in fact, did it end up not producing savings, all that sort of thing. And so as the legislature began to consider the possibility of a RIP bill, that was, I think, a very important part of the background, because there were some changes in how this RIP was plan and bill were developed to address some of those concerns. The governor had expressed early on in the administration his interest in RIP as a tool for downsizing, not just a tool for saving money, but also looking at our need to have a smaller state government, that this was a better way to do it than have a situation where people were laid off, that it was a way to manage the attrition in a positive way from the individual employee standpoint. But we tried to make it very clear all the way from the beginning that in no way would this be considered an employee right or an across-the-board RIP to which every employee was entitled regardless of the situation. At one point, as many of you probably recall, the legislature actually was thinking about modifying the proposed RIP bill so that RIP would be allowed only in situations where the positions would be vacant. There's no room for disagreement about whether there's a savings. If you're eliminating the position altogether, then clearly there is a savings, and you don't have to debate whether it was enough to overcome the employer cost and so on. And in the number of times that I testified in various committees on the House and Senate side as the bill moved through, we urged the legislature to retain the provision which allowed us to replace in some cases, because there were certain areas of state responsibility where we didn't think there was any opportunity or where it would not be reasonable for us to reduce the number of employees, but where we felt there would be a chance for some real cost savings. And some of the areas that we highlighted in that were places like 24-hour institutions, where we didn't feel we were going to be able to reduce the number of prison guards or of folks who were in charge of custody of people. Same situation in the troopers. We certainly, as a state, were not looking to reduce the total number of troopers, but we realized that there are many, many folks in those positions who are far out on the seniority, and so there really could be a substantial savings if newer folks came in. So in the end, the legislature did decide to retain that provision that allowed us to replace, but I think it was very clear, certainly in my testimony to you and in what I heard from legislators, that this was not intended to be an employee benefit or a situation where all positions would automatically be refilled. So there were also a couple of other differences in how this bill was put together, again, to address the legislative concerns that prior RIPs had not generated the kinds of savings anticipated. One of those changes that does make a significant difference in whether employees are eligible is that we must have savings under the bill within 3 years, not 5 years, which had been the case under the previous RIP. When you shorten the time period, you increase the likelihood of accuracy of calculations because you're not getting as speculative, but that also means that not everyone will qualify in 3 years who might qualify in, if the savings could take 5 years to achieve. Another change was that this RIP was authorized for a three-year period of time, and that was to acknowledge that the state was going through a period of budget reductions, and under either plan, the majority plan or the governor's plan, we were talking about multiple-year budget reductions. And so people were acknowledging that there was going to have to be reduction in cost and probably reductions in sheer numbers of employees over a longer period of time than 1 year. We did not require departments to submit plans by any particular deadline. This is an open window. It's intended to be used as appropriate in the various departments so that not every department is on the same schedule for a whole host of reasons. And so we continue to get RIP plans from departments and expect to have RIPs not only in this fiscal year but in future fiscal years. But there's no guarantee for an employee that there will be a RIP at any particular time, nor is there a guarantee that every single employee who is eligible would be offered a RIP. And there are a number of reasons for that. In some cases, it does not fit with the programmatic needs of the department. We can't always have a situation, for instance, where we lose the people who have the longest training, the most expertise, a whole host of factors that may mean that a RIP is not appropriate, even when there is some cost savings. In some cases, the cost savings may be very marginal, and then you've got a real trade-off in terms of the amount of time it takes to train somebody to fill the position. We did make a lot of effort last year, and I think this was echoed in a lot of the press attention, to draw some distinctions between the RIP bill that was under discussion and prior RIPs, to continue to say and to be sure that reporters were pointing out that this was not an across-the-board RIP and so forth, and that there were going to be some changes. In July, we did send a letter to every employee who would be eligible just from the standpoint of how old you were and years of service and so on, to again let them know this was not across the board. And I've included for you in your packet a copy of that letter to state employees. And it says just dear state employee, but it was mailed to, again, those people who would be on lists of people potentially eligible for RIP. We also did, when we learned that there was a lot of confusion on the part of employees about, well, why do I not qualify? The person sitting at the desk next to me is the same age. How come that person does and I don't? So we tried to get information out to employees with fact sheets that explain the differences in the actuarial calculations. And if you have those kinds of questions, the folks who are here from Retirement and Benefits will be the best to answer them, because that's not an area that I've got expertise in. Despite this effort to be sure that employees realized that this was not an across-the-board RIP, that there was an emphasis on reducing the number of positions or downgrading positions, using this as a chance to rethink how a department or a program was run, we still had a lot of employees who thought that it was going to be offered to everybody. I've heard stories of people who had bought motorhomes expecting that they would be allowed to RIP as soon as the bill passed, and you know, some of those may be more rumors than truth, but what I mention it to convey to you that we did realize that this was an area that was going to create some question in employees' minds, and that's partly why we were doing things like these individual letters to try to get that word out. But lots of paper comes across people's desks both at home and at work, so it doesn't surprise me if there's still people who are not aware of some of those differences. We did distribute to all departments the instructions, and I've also included those for you that outlined how savings would have to be calculated. I had made commitments in my testimony, and that I have a responsibility under the bill to certify that there are going to be savings. And some of the decisions are pretty easy to make. They're clear in the bill, like 3 years versus five, things like that. There are also some areas, frankly, where it does have to be a judgment call to say, well, is this a case where it's reasonable to assume that there will be moving costs, because we know from all of our past experience that you can't find folks locally, let's say in some of the smaller communities, and that we always have to pay for someone to go from a larger community to move out. Those are some judgment calls that we've had to make along the lines. Again, it was something I felt I needed to do if I was going to be able to say to you there have been savings from this RIP program. I couldn't always just say, well, I know there have always had to be moving costs, but let's not count them in this time. So the actual savings that will come from RIP, two answers really to that question. One is the appropriations last year did have $1.5 million as the RIP savings. We have allocated that out to the departments based on the kind of ratio of how many people they had that were eligible. But frankly, if a department's RIP plans don't manage to get that kind of savings, the departments still are going to have to come up with that. So we will achieve the $1.5 million reduction in the budget, because that's how we structured it from the beginning. It's very hard for us to predict at this point what will the savings be, even after we approve a RIP plan, and that's for a number of reasons. Just because we approve a RIP plan, let's say that has 50 employees in it, those employees are not required to take the RIP, and we could end up with a huge variation. It might be that only a few people choose to RIP, or it may be that the only people who choose to RIP are the ones for whom the dollar savings is relatively small. So giving you any estimate at this point is very difficult. We are required under the bill to provide a report to you next January summarizing the actual savings to date, and we're tracking that so that we can give you an accurate report. But the RIP plans that come forward to me show a maximum savings possible, but the caveat is that that would only be true if every single employee RIPed and if all the replacement positions came in as projected. I'll defer to Bob Stolnaker the questions about why some eligible employees show savings and others don't in terms of the actuarial calculations. Again, there are lots of other factors that have to be taken into account, things like whether there is a cost of training the new employee, any other costs like moving expenses that would have to be taken into account. Let me just say a word or two about the process, and then I'll explain the chart here. Departments do submit to OMB their proposed plans for RIP. We verify whether the savings calculations are accurate, and that's been a lot easier because we've provided a spreadsheet, so it's generally not been a problem. We take a look at whether the department has included any costs of replacing employees, if those positions are going to be replaced. And we evaluate whether or not we feel there are sufficient numbers of position deletions or downgrades to make a good faith effort toward the downsizing part of the goal of all of this. There is no hard and fast rule of thumb. I don't require X percent of the employee or of the positions be downgraded or deleted. It seems to me that just given the huge variety in the kinds of work our departments do, that would be impossible. I couldn't come up with a single figure that would be appropriate in every case. But I do insist, particularly in administrative areas or in areas where there could be some potential for reorganizing how services are provided, I do insist that departments take a hard look at that. And if there is no effort in the plan to do any reduction in the number of positions or to downgrade any positions, I send it back and I ask the department to take another look. Because there's a dual goal here. One is cost savings, and the other is bringing down the numbers of people in as humane a way as possible, and obviously that's the reason for a RIP as opposed to a layoff. The chart that we've provided for you, this horizontal thing with the black band across the top, summarizes where we are as of all the plans that have been approved to date. First column is simply the number of full-time positions in the departments that have submitted those plans to us, the number of positions that they have listed total in their RIP plan, and again, they're not required to do it on any time frame. They can do that as their operational plans warrant, and they can also do it within different parts. The statute actually said you could have it by geographic area, by job class, by program, so that some departments have brought us plans at different stages, two or three plans. The number of positions that are deleted in the plan, these are the number of positions where they are not allowed to refill them, and we're actually wiping those positions off the books. Positions downgraded. Another category of holding open 3 months, in some cases, it's premature to tell, particularly when departments are in the process of reorganizing some of their work activities. It's premature to know exactly where those position deletions will be. So, for instance, in the Department of Transportation, they're undergoing review of how they do some of their administrative functions. And rather than say exactly which positions would be deleted, we have said to them, you're in the middle of doing this plan. You can come back to us when you complete that, and we'll review the RIP in that context. Then the following column is how many positions we are authorizing them to refill. That number is large in a couple of cases. That's in corrections and in public safety, and that's because those are limited to the correction and probation officers. We don't think it's wise to reduce the number of those, and same for troopers and public safety. The application period is the time during which an employee would file an application for a RIP. But the person is not actually obligated to RIP just because they filed an application. We don't necessarily know that they will take the RIP until they actually submit their resignation. Last date of by which they must retire, I've put that in there partly so that you can see that in many cases, although we've had 46 people who've actually retired, we still have some open windows and some retire dates that are going to be around a lot of them falling right around the end of the fiscal year. So it may well be that number in the far right-hand column, we know it will continue to build as people make their plans and decide whether they want to RIP or not. So those numbers in the last two columns on the right, the caveat there is that that's a work in progress, and we won't know until the deadlines that are in the previous two columns how many people actually retire. As I said, this departments are doing them on all different schedules, so I can provide a periodic update, maybe once a month or so, or once every 6 weeks, and just give you an update of the number of plans submitted as of that time. That's, I think, the gist of what I had to summarize.
Kelly and I represent Martin.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Hanley, on, where was it? There was a column here where the positions would not be refilled.
That's positions deleted in plan, where those positions will actually be completely removed, taken off the books.
So essentially, I guess the bottom line here is that we had 37 positions that were eliminated in a total of 46 or 85? Oh, 85 people that actually took advantage of the RIP program.
Well, those are just the people who have retired so far, but for a lot of these people, if you look in the third column from the right, most of the dates by which they have to retire, we haven't hit yet.
Sure.
So people will continue to be retiring.
How does that number then say, and you may not have this information, but a certain number of people are going to retire every year anyway.
Right.
Have you backed out the number of people that you would naturally have retire to come up with that number?
We haven't, and the reason, and this was something that was discussed quite a bit in the hearings last year, there's no precise way that we can say, well, this person would have retired anyway, and so on. That was one of the criticisms about a RIP plan to begin with, that if you have a RIP plan or you know there will be a RIP plan, everybody holds off and waits until they find out if the plan will be offered. That's one of the reasons why we've been very careful in projecting savings, not to err on the high side, because we recognize that some employees would have retired in any event. But it's hard to predict exactly what that number would be. Just a number I meant to mention to you, in the prior RIPs, approximately 20, I think it was about 28%, yeah, 28% of the people who were offered the RIP in the prior plans actually took it. So, even within that context, even within these numbers, we don't know how this RIP will compare to prior practice. It may be very different since it's not an across-the-board RIP.
Mr. Chairman, Frank, positions in the RIP plan, so down at the bottom here, there are essentially, you're saying there are 1,161 people as it sits now who are eligible for this and may be eligible over a certain window of time?
There are 1,161 people who are have been notified by the departments that they have the opportunity to apply for a RIP, that those are the approved RIP plans. There's a larger number of employees who, by virtue just of their age and service, would be eligible. Then you take a cut down because not all of those will show a savings because of the employer cost that has to be provided and so on. And then it's within that subset that departments offer up a proposed plan.
Thank you. Representative Martin.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Lee, earlier today we received a letter, a copy from the Commissioner of Transportation that went to the two co-chairmen pertaining to the RIP. And in there, what I like, I called the Commissioner Perkins up and thank him for the good detail. He showed the actual deletion of the position numbers. And this is the thing I wanted to get to, is that you have the position deleted from the plan. And I want to go further. Do we mean just deleted from current occupancy, that we will leave it vacant, or will we actually remove the PCN number? And then when we remove the PCN number, what authorization is needed to get it off the books completely? Because, you know, we keep on authorizing these new positions, but no one takes them off the book, it seems like. And so 5 years down the line, it gets filled in again. I'm like you, what you said at the beginning, we want to make sure that these positions are permanently deleted. It's the number one way of saving money.
Representative Martin, these positions will actually be taken off the books, so those PCNs will be deleted, and that's specifically so that it doesn't just go away for a few months and then be refilled later on. So that is the understanding with the departments, is when they submit a plan or we approve a plan that has a position deletion, that PCN will be eliminated. Now, again, we don't know in advance which employees will decide to accept the offer to RIP. So in some cases, it's possible that a department will propose to delete a particular position, but if that employee doesn't RIP, the position will continue to be filled. So that's the one caveat. Your mention of DOT reminded me, I had wanted to flag for you that we did run into some problems, and it's been an issue mostly in DOT, where the federal government is not allowing us to use federal funds as a legitimate source of money for RIP. The irony of this is that the federal government has its own RIP plan, and much of what we did here is modeled after some of the provisions in the federal RIP. So it seems kind of ironic that they think it's an appropriate tool for them, but in the case of the Federal Highway Administration, they have said that we cannot use federal highway funds to provide the employer's share of the RIP expense. What that would mean is if an employee who is 100% federally funded, or largely federally, not even 100%, but has federal funding, we would have to use pure general funds to pay for that. Well, that puts an extra strain on the general fund budget. We have asked for reconsideration of that federal policy, and so far we've not made progress, although we've brought it to the attention also of Senator Stevens' office. Because that would be like the state saying to school districts, we're allowing you to have a RIP, but you can't use any foundation formula money as a source of employer costs for a RIP. So.
When that DOT report, most of those are CIPs, and of course they're contracts. Why wouldn't it be just after that federal contract or that job is done, partly with federal money, that ends with that employee instead of going to the next project or that PCN number?
Well, if I'm understanding your question correctly, employees let's say in design and construction for DOT work on a number of projects. They're not just hired for this project and then they go away, because we have every year we have projects that need design and construction management and so forth. So employees are hired and then they may work on, in fact they may work simultaneously on more than one federal road project.
What is to prevent, say, maybe 4 years down the line when I'm not here and no one else is here that's been working on this, from a department to reactivating that CPN number? I was wondering, do we need some legislation to repeal previous authorization?
Well, there is no final prohibition on a position being created later on. However, a couple of things. One is, we never know what the future is going to bring, and so it probably would not be a good idea, in my opinion, it would not at all be a good idea, to say that once a PCN is eliminated, it can never be back. We may find that we need to have a particular position again 5 years from now, even though there might be a four-year period of time when we don't need it. We have done a tremendous amount, and I say we, I don't mean just OMB, I mean departments, have done a tremendous amount of cleanup in the last couple of years of vacant PCNs. It is true that in many cases there were PCNs that had been vacant for a long time and remained that way. On the other hand, we also have vacant positions where we've certainly hoped that they could one day be filled, trooper vacancies, for instance. And some positions, because of the vacancy factor, the way that we handle personnel and the vacancy factor in our budget, ends up meaning you always have some positions vacant in any event.
Vacancy, I can understand. It's just that once you decide for the purpose of this trip of really saving money and decreasing the number of employees to get rid of that PCN position, and why couldn't legislators come back once it's been deleted and reauthorize it if the department says, hey, we need that now, 5 years later, new capital project, the state has passed out $1 billion in projects, then we need those positions. Well, then let the new legislature decide that with the new administration.
I think that's what would happen. She said they're going to eliminate
so, yeah.
The PCN.
PCN
will be eliminated. 5 years from now, they decide we need more people in ADA because they're doing a lot of business and they've eliminated those positions, and they'll come in their budget and say, I need three new positions.
Yeah. I just didn't want them to do it on their own. You know.
I think they have to come through the... Well, they can create PCNs, but I don't think there's got to be the money to fund
them.
What
they can't create is the money, right? So, exactly.
You mentioned on this 1161, the positions in the RIP plan, I think I heard you say that this is who was notified, and I'm just curious.
These are the plans that have been approved by OMB as actually not all of them, because we don't approve, obviously, the legislature's plan, court system, and so on, but just using as an example, in administration, retirement, and benefits, five positions were in the plan that was brought forward. Those five people have been notified that a RIP plan is being offered, and they can decide whether they would like to take the RIP or not. So this is not the number of people who may be offered RIP at some time in the future. It's just the ones who've so far been offered the RIP opportunity. Now, in some cases, there are a couple of plans that have just been approved, so the letters may still be in the mail, but 1,100 positions have been approved, authorized, to offer to employees the opportunity to take the RIP. Part of our difficulty has been all these words of eligible, because there's sort of these different eligibility steps along the way.
I'm going to ask one more question, but we do have a number of people that want to testify too. So what I'd like to do is I'll ask one more if anybody else has any now. Go through a number of the people that want to testify. I think we're up to 20 folks that want to testify now and hear some input, and then try and have Anna Lee or whoever she would like come back and maybe answer some of the questions that have arisen from testimony and people that have come forward. My question goes to Health and Social Services Harborview. You're showing 69 positions in the RIP plan, 54.
Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah.
54 can be refilled.
Yeah, I'm sorry. I missed an edit here. I meant to take off the word Harborview there, because when we submitted this to the Senate a month ago or whatever, or Senate Finance, at that point the only plan that had been approved was Harborview's plan, which was just a smaller number of the positions. There's now another HESS plan that has been reviewed, so the Harborview positions have been deleted, but some of the other HESS positions were authorized to be refilled. So that's if you just cross off the word Harborview, that'll be.
Okay, I guess my question is, and I don't remember the numbers, it's somewhere in the 60-person range still working at Harborview. And Harborview's going to close in December, I believe, that's the estimated date anyway, of this year, 97. So the way we had anticipated it anyway, and I know we're working on other functions and what we do with the people there, but we are putting extra money in because the people in the communities are not going into state facilities, they're going into community-based programs. There were almost 100 people working at Harborview, and I'm curious, it doesn't seem like some of those should be able to be refilled. I mean, Harborview is a very specific circumstance, and I don't know that I need the answer right now, but if there's 100, I guess we'd like to know what has happened to those particular positions. Now, if some of those people are moving to other positions in other communities or within the community, that's fine, but that's not a refilling of that position because Harborview is actually being phased out.
No, the Harborview positions are not being refilled. There were some employees who have accepted other jobs in the department or jobs in other departments, and of course, that's not part of the these RIP numbers if somebody took another job somewhere else as the phase out was beginning. So the remaining positions at Harborview are being deleted, but much as there's been an effort over the last several months or however long it's been now to work with employees, and if somebody is interested in taking a position, including positions outside of Valdez, that has happened along the way.
Okay, I guess eventually I would like to have just a Harborview breakdown, how many
sure.
positions are eliminated versus how many people are ripping, and I don't need that right now.
And actually, I think I have that right here because I think I have, it was the version that we had provided previously, and we had given a copy to you all as well. The Harborview had 15 positions in the plan, and all 15 were deleted. So the number you see here includes the 15 that were deleted that are Harborview, and then an additional number of positions beyond that for other areas. The other clarification that should be on here is public safety. The reason all of those are refilled is that's trooper positions.
Representative Davis.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. If I can get this clear, Annalee, the positions in the RIP plan, so that's the three-year period. That's the full of the legislation that passed, or
no,
is that just this one year?
That's just the ones so far. So that's
okay.
Only the plans approved as of today. And so we will continue to get additional numbers of plans, and that number would grow then as we approve other plans.
Okay.
And I don't... We don't really have a tally of how many positions statewide potentially could show cost savings, because that only comes forward once a department has worked out a plan. So, but many of the positions simply don't show a savings. When you calculate the employer cost and in some cases cost of training or whatever, the state would actually lose money by offering the RIP. So those don't even get considered further. Even though those people were originally on a list that said you're old enough and you've worked for the state a long enough period of time. And I think that's where some of the confusion has arisen.
Representative. I think you mentioned that you had a spreadsheet. This was something that was sent to me, and I'm wondering if this is what you mentioned. Has current cost year one, current cost year two, replacement cost year one, is that...
Squished little version. I'm not quite sure. On the back page of your packet is kind of the model form that we use. This is just the Excel spreadsheet we sent out to departments that they could use to calculate the costs and savings. And so what the department would do is plug in for a particular, and they would have to do this for each position. They would plug in what that person's current range and step is, the benefit costs, et cetera. If the position is eliminated, then, of course, all of that money is a savings. If there is a replacement, they have to tell us the proposed range and step of the replacement. So that's how if they're sort of reorganizing how they do things and there's a downgrade, that would show up there. And then the employer RIP cost is provided by retirement and benefits. That's so on. So that's all. Just sort of, that's the calculation that they walk through. And so at the bottom, number 11, unless there's a savings that's shown on the bottom line, the department the bill requires that each position show a savings. So if a person doesn't show a savings after walking through this calculation, the department just stops right there and can't bring it forward to me. Well, I mean, they could, I guess, but there'd be no reason to do that. The bill requires a savings for every single position.
A follow-up there. So would you then, if it shows a savings, but it's rather small, would you then look to see kind of down the road what would happen to the savings? I mean, if you bring somebody on that's, you don't go from a 22M, but you're not really going to go to a 22B either. You're going to bring somebody on that was the deputy commissioner's assistant or something that has moved up the range scale. So you bring somebody on that's maybe at a 20 A or B or something like that. But there's going to be a shift all the way down the line maybe as people bump up. Do you track that cost then to see if it's eroded away, and then make a further determination that, yes, you know, the first blush there was a savings, but when you look down the road a little bit, it's eroded away.
That's very difficult to project, and for a number of reasons. One of which is, for instance, we've told told the departments that they have to calculate if there's a replacement. They have to calculate at a B step, and that's acknowledging that you don't always bring somebody in an entry, but we never know for sure, particularly in a situation where people have seniority rights to move into a position, we can't say for sure who will actually fill that position. So it could in some cases be somebody coming in at an A step, it might be somebody coming in at a C step, but to carry it on down the chain becomes more and more speculative because of promotion rules and all sorts of other factors. But again, that's one of the reasons why we've been so careful not to overstate the initial savings, because we know that there are those kinds of factors that come into play. Or the one I mentioned earlier, which is you might have, let's say, five positions in a plan. One of those positions might show a savings of $30,000 over 3 years. Another might show a savings of $300 over 3 years. Well, you don't know for sure which employee is going to retire. So you may end up with a $30,000, or you may end up with a $300, or you might get the two together. Because there's so much uncertainty, we've tried to be really careful about not overstating that first level of calculation.
I think I'd like to go to the teleconference and get some testimony so that we can...
And I'll stay for any questions afterwards.
That would be great.
Sure.
So we can get some of the comments from individuals who want to testify on this. And I'll start off on the teleconference, and we'll try and move around here. I'm going to start in Barrow, since they have the most people signed up to testify. The first person I have is Jim Wood.
Thank you for the opportunity to address the group. I'll defer my time at this point right now.
Are there other people there that would like... One of the things, we have about 20 people, and so I'm going to... You know, anybody can testify if you have the same things to say, or if you have specific questions that you would like us to get answered. Either specific to your case or in general, please bring those up so that we can eventually get them answered. I'm not going to probably do a one-on-one debate with each person, but we'd like to get a list of all the concerns that are out there. Or I know people have expressed feelings that there's inequities within the system, and so I'd like to get those out on the table so that we can get them answered by Anna Lee. And if people can hang on to the line, if we go back to a particular question, then someone could... Further explain their situation. Is Jim Christensen there?
Yes, I am. Thank you for this opportunity to provide some comments on the RIP. Just by way of background, I work for the North Slope Borough Department of Public Safety, and I've been there for over 19 years. I'd like to just make comments about my opinion as to how the RIP bill is affecting municipal government participation as opposed to state employees. And one of the things that seems to impact the number of people that are eligible is the time window from which savings must be recaptured, a three-year time window. And it's my understanding that in 1989, the last RIP bill that was offered that affected municipalities had a time window of 3 years, and the legislature had to come back in 1990 and amend that law to add, to change that three-year window to a five-year window. So I would like to suggest that maybe Ms. McDowell later on might be able to comment on whether or not what the impact of extending the savings period of the employees' savings over five as opposed to 3 years, and I'd like to recommend that if any legislation is considered in this matter, that time window would be extended to five. I also would like to recommend that if there is any legislation regarding this particular matter, that they add language that would allow the employee to make up the difference in cost savings. For example, if the employee was $100 short from showing a cost savings, that he could put out that money out of his own pocket, should he so choose, to make the savings, because in the long run, the government is still going to save money. I also would just like to state regarding that three-year and five-year window for savings periods, the school district RIP bill, which included not only TERS employees, but other PERS employees working for school districts, which was passed under a different law last year, did have that same time, five-year time frame window as opposed to the three-year time frame. And I think that's essentially what I'd like to add right now. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Christensen. Is Betty Jo Savage there?
This is Betty Savage. I'd like to hear some more information from around the state, because before I... I'm trying to find out what's going on.
Okay. How about, I'm going to go to Anchorage. Is Dan Kelly there?
Yes, I am here. Thank you very much. I appreciate the opportunity to have this, to discuss this with you. I'm with the Department of Transportation, and there's a lot of people that work there that are both paid with federal funds and a lot of them that are paid out just general fund money, but there seems to be a lot of inequity because, or perceived that way because of the type of response that they're getting. In essence, the majority of the people feel that the program is too restrictive. That's why a lot of people won't even be taking this RIP, because they do, you know, they do have the age and they do have the number of years that would allow them to do it. But because it's so restrictive, they won't be given that chance by the administration. Therefore, it presents a lot of irritation among the troops, and they're very disappointed about it. I've been told by an individual that there's a lot of problem with the comparable costs in this program. We've not had a chance to see the actual calculations themselves. We have seen a spreadsheet that said, did give us some numbers, but how those numbers are actually derived at in the first place, we're not available. And so consequently, we really couldn't respond to those letters that came from OMB in any definitive way so that we could say, well, yes, but this isn't correct, or yes, this is correct for that matter. We did notice that, or I did notice that, that on our particular sheet that was given us, that it was saying that we're 100% federally funded. I don't work for the federal government. I work for the state of Alaska. I'm not 100% federally funded. However, because I do work on federal projects, that number is up around 90%, or somewhat a little bit less than that. And an individual who's an administrator for us, I was talking to him today, and he had mentioned the fact that some of the charges that goes against the federal dollars for these projects go into the retirement system itself. In other words, well, they're saying that so much an hour is being charged for this individual for sick leave, for health costs, for retirement, for services that he provides. And so when you're comparing that number after they retire, I have to ask the question, why not go ahead and prorate a charge for the retirement system so that the federal costs would be included in the future as well as in the current? It would seem reasonable and over a statistical platform, I'm sure that an individual could come up with a reasonable percentage to do that. The other thing I have is, well, there seems to be a lot of inconsistency about whether or not we want to save money for the state, and yet we're not interested in saving money for the feds. I have a problem with that because I believe if we're all citizens of the United States and those people in Alaska are... And we're not trying to save federal dollars. I got a problem with that. I don't think that's realistic. But I know that their charge is to try to protect the state's money. The subject was brought up about the 3 years versus the 5 years. It's been calculated by some of people in our office that a 3-year program, as shown on our spreadsheet to receive, didn't actually save it much money. But, well, over 5 years, they did save money. And so I'm saying, well, if it can save money over 5 years, then why not go ahead and use that? Because in the long run, you will save over everybody even more with that 5-year window, or that 5-year period. I'm real curious also that in my particular instance, 6 months ago, we negative number that said that I wouldn't be eligible. The number was like $465. And then we received one just a week ago that recalculated again, and I thought, well, gee, this ought to be good. I opened it up, and it went from minus 465 to a minus $37,000. I have a real rough time believing those kind of numbers, so perhaps we need a little bit more explanation from OMB as to how those calculations were actually come up with. The final thing I have to say is that if you can save money in the 5 years, then by golly, we ought to maybe just go with that. And I recommend that we revise the bill so that it can take care of some of these inequities that everybody feels in their hearts. We need to try to have as equal treatment as we can across the board. Years ago, in 1989, you say, well, if everybody who was eligible to retire could retire, there wasn't any dissension in the troops. Now you have dissension in the troops, and only a few people can retire. Yet that, back in 89, there was a savings. We can still receive a savings now. Why not go ahead and change the RIF bill, realize your savings, but make it fair treatment across the board. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Kelly. Just so you know, what I think I heard Ms. McConnell say about the federal funds is a problem that may exist not because of what they want to do, because I think, as you explained it, I think they would like to apportion a percentage of the federal funds that are saved towards the RIP costs. I think what she said was they are not allowed to by the federal government, and that it would save money for the federal government as well. But because of their rules, they are not allowed, and I think she said they're trying to pursue that. So I think it may be a bit of a catch-22 with some of the federal funds, because it would work except for the fact that people like yourself are 90% federally funded. So any cost of the RIP program that would normally be picked up if they were using the savings in the federal funds would now have to be picked up straight out of general funds. And so the cost to the general fund, there is no savings to the general fund. There would be a big savings to the federal fund, but it's actually going to cost us money in the general fund to allow certain people who have federal funded positions or largely federally funded positions to do that. So I'll ask Anna Lee to shake her head yes or no if that's correct, or maybe she could just briefly speak to that.
That is correct, and I think the speaker pointed out that the feds do allow us to cover the normal retirement costs, so that makes it seem doubly ironic, because we do charge our regular retirement as part of the employee cost under federal projects, but the federal government does, and this is not across the board. Some federal programs do allow us to cover employer costs, but the Federal Highway Administration has a national policy that forbids us to charge RIP costs. So we are still trying to pursue and see if we can get a change in that, but
right. So
no success so far.
At least for Mr. Kelly on that particular issue, I don't think, I mean, you can disagree on the 3 years it was in the bill or some other problems, but I think they are trying to work that out because they also realize there would be a benefit both to the federal government and to the state.
Is this program still set up for, comparing apples to apples, for example, 3 years from my being away from the state services and 3 years from my replacement, or is it 3 years from my replacement and 21 years for my life expectancy, which was actuarially adjusted? What's the explanation there?
Your life is your life.
I
don't think anybody understood the question, Mr. Kelly.
Okay, let me try again. I understand, like in the case where we had a $465 negative number, came back with another number that was extremely larger, say $37,000. I kind of questioned, well, why, you know, how the calculations differed, and I was told, but I don't know this for a fact, but I was told that it was because of the actuary or the adjustments that were made in the calculations that extended the same cost for the period from the time I retire until the time of my life expectancy ends versus just the 3 years for the replacement cost of the employee. I don't know whether that's true, but I would like to know. I'd like your comment on it.
Well, Mr. Kelly, it's hard for me to comment, and we can ask them, but frankly, in some of these specific cases, it would be very helpful for you to either write us a letter or contact Mr. Stallnaker or personally, so he can ask you specific questions about your case, get the details, and maybe the spreadsheets that were utilized, because in each case you're going to find different circumstances. And I think he can maybe comment generally, but I'm not sure we'll get to the bottom of yours without you giving some very specific information, and I don't know that you necessarily want to do that over the air in a public forum, but we'd be more than happy to, you know, if you want to work it through my office, or if you can, just call Mr. Stalnaker directly, talk to him, and if you don't get satisfaction, then call my office, and I'll talk to Mr. Stalnaker after that to get his view, but, you know, maybe we can work it that way.
Thank you very much.
And let me give you, what's your number, Mr. Stallman? or who do you want us to call, Annalise?
Well, Mr. Chairman, for the record, I'm Bob Stallnaker, Director for the Division of Retirement and Benefits. Certainly, we've encouraged people to call about actuarial costs because it does differ from one employee to the next. And that is taken on actuarial life expectancy. My number is 465-907-465-4470, and I can certainly direct them to the person to talk to. More logically, it would be myself or Bill Church, who's our retirement manager, and Bill can be reached at the same number.
Okay. Representative Kelly?
Thank you. I have a question. I'm a little lost on this federal dollar question and as it relates to RIP costs. When you talk about the RIP costs, you're really not talking about the retirement incentive program costs. You're really talking just about retirement costs, correct? You're not talking about costs over and above the cost of a normal retirement.
The normal retirement is something that we can charge against federal projects. The regular calculation of how much gets contributed to an employee's retirement account. The place where some federal agencies, and the biggest problem has been the Federal Highway Administration, have said no is for retirement incentive programs, because their interpretation is this is not a requirement. You don't have to offer RIP to every, it's not an employee right or benefit that's across the board, and therefore they don't want their federal dollars spent on that. The irony is that while it would cost us something initially, we've said we could build more roads if we had a, if we showed a cost saving. So we're still trying to pursue this, and as I said, have so far not had any success. We flagged it for Senator Stevens' office as an issue that maybe he can help with.
So a state employee essentially who is working off of federal funds, some of the federal funds that come in that allow that employee to participate, work on projects that are federally funded, a portion of the federal funds that come in over the course that employee's life are dedicated towards retirement of that employee?
Let me jump in real quick, because I think I understand what Representative Kelly's asking. Normally, you pay into the retirement system. Once you're retired, you don't pay into the system anymore. You've got an investment, and there's all kinds of things that earns money, and you're paid out based on actuarial numbers or however the contracts are written. So, you know, once you retire, you don't pay anymore. There is a cost to a RIP because somebody is retiring either earlier than they would have or getting extra years. So you can't say, for instance, buy 3 years and not work those years because you're not putting the money in. So you have to, somebody's got to put the money into the system even though you're not continually working, and that's where the cost comes from.
I got it now. That's the retirement cost you're talking about, is the excess, not just the...
If my job were fully federally funded, under normal programs, they could charge not only my take-home pay, but they could also we could also charge the cost of my health insurance, the cost of my usual retirement, and that's just part of the cost that allowed to be charged to the federal grants.
Thank you. Good.
Okay. Let's go to... another person. Hank Harrell, are you online?
Yes, I am.
If you could, just for the record, give your name and then go ahead with any testimony that you have.
My name is Hank Harrell. I work at the Fairbanks Correctional Center for the Department of Correction. I've done so for 18 years and 4 months. I filled out the necessary paperwork to see if I qualified for the RIP deal, and I was denied. So there would not be a cost savings to let me participate. However, I'm here today to bring up a point that I think has been overlooked, and I've been sitting here listening. To me, it appears that someone in the Office of Management and Budget has been, I don't know, for lack of a better word, frightened.
15 step L. If I was allowed to participate in RIP build and retire, with the number of officers that are working in corrections, I assume, like the troopers, there would have to be a replacement. That person would be hired at the salary range of 11, step 8. That difference between my salary and that person's salary, the savings would be over $20,000. I understand that there will be a promotion for someone, and I overheard someone say something about step B earlier during the hearing. I can't understand, even with a person being promoted and a new hire and the training, how it could be determined there would not be a savings by letting a person of salary range 15 step B retire. What I have observed, the people that have been have gotten letters here in the last few weeks that told them that they did qualify to retire. Those have been people that have not worked shift work. They worked a regular 40-hour work week, and they did not have the high salaries that the people who have been denied the opportunity to participate in the RIP bill. But those people, at least we consider them a medium range salary versus people that work shift work, holiday, overtime. And most of us, well, actually all of us at our institution have been told no, that if we did not qualify, there wouldn't be a savings. As I stated, I honestly don't think that the people in the Office of Management and Budget have taken that step to figure down if there's going to be a savings. And I think that needs to be done. And in addition to that, I would like to see them take, if a state employee pays for their TIHAR time, they should include that in figuring it up and letting the person retire if they qualify for the RIP here. That's basically what I had to say, and I would like to add one last thing. If it takes an amendment to the RIP bill, I understood that it was to get rid of the people that made the high salaries and bring in people at less cost. I honestly don't think this is being done. That's all I got to say. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. I don't know. Again, it's probably one of those specific circumstances. I don't know if you heard the phone number for Mr. Stalnaker. We're going to have them out here, but I mean, do you have an appeals process, or obviously you're getting calls right now from people as to why they're being denied, I would assume, and
The retirement benefits folks have spoken with lots of employees about their own individual calculations. For the person calling from Fairbanks, I am the person in OMB who signs those. I did not refuse any of the positions that came forward to me in the corrections plan for corrections officers and probation officers. All of the ones that came forward to me did show a cost savings, and so if there, you know, there's always an opportunity to look again and see if there was a mistake in the calculations made in a department. But I did not turn any of them down. All of them satisfied the requirement for a cost savings.
Okay. So I don't know if you heard
so
that.
The particular situation would be one we'd have to look at,
sure,
based on the employer cost. Because, again, that's the part that's hard. When you just see the 15L to 11A, what you don't see is the other side of the equation, and that's the employer cost. And that is the actuarial calculation. But we could certainly follow up with any employees. And I know Retirement and Benefits has done that a lot already with people who have questions.
Mr. Stalnaker.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, I think Mr. Harrell brings out a question that's probably asked very, very frequently. I'm a correction officer. My other correction officer works a different shift, but we're both correction officers. How come that correction officer shows a savings or has a lower actuarial cost than I do? Well, as Mr. Harrell pointed out, he works a different shift, makes quite a bit more money. And when you figure actuarially, one of the key elements of a calculation of a retirement benefit is the salary the person makes. If they're a higher paid person, the additional cost for the additional service will be higher, with just that alone, not counting the person's age or length of service or some of the other things. So it's very common that you'd have two similarly situated people that, because of a little bit different salary or age or so forth, would have significantly different costs for the RIP part or the actuarial costs.
Thank you. If we could go to Mr. Robert Bladorn in Kenai.
Hi. Thanks for letting me address this. My name is Bob Bladorn. I'm employed by the Department of Corrections as a field probation officer in Kenai. I've worked for the state of Alaska since 3-18-95, when I first became a correctional officer. I have prior service in PERS dating back to 1980. I'd just like to say that I believe the criteria used to establish the cost savings for the purposes of the RIP are an error, and I think unfair. In order to be able to retire, a person must show a cost saving. With the methods used to establish this, a person with literally any cost savings is eligible, as opposed to somebody who shows a $5 mark in the RIP is automatically ineligible, so to speak. I'm eligible to retire now as new age, and I am service-wise eligible to retire August 1st of this year. But I cannot RIP because of the 6/30/97 time frame, and retirement and benefits said that I am $4,797 in the red. I am a Tier 1 employee and was hired prior to 1986. And as it stands now, I'm at the top of my pay scale in the 16 range, not in longevity. There have been two revisions to the state employees' pay and benefits since I've been hired. This, coupled with the state hiring probation officer ones at a lower pay scale and benefits, that alone should be an enormous cost savings to the state. I was informed by retirement and benefits that my director, Linda Zog, in Anchorage, told them to factor in replacing retiring PO2s with PO2s. I find this difficult to believe. The probation officer twos who would be on the list of eligibility to be hired usually qualify on paper only. I know this because this is how I got started in the field as a correctional officer two. No matter if they're a probation officer two on the list, they're still going to have to be trained for the job, and eventually somewhere down the line a probation officer one will have to be hired. Is it more of a cost savings to hire a probation officer one and train them than to have to pay for a probation officer two and train them? The other thing that bothered me is I read an article in the Anchorage Daily News a while back that said the state workers were lukewarm to the RIP. This, I find, is not so. I want to RIP with every fiber of my being, but I'm unable to. We've made the rules tough and stringent. And there are a number of people I know who want to retire but can't because the procedure is too harsh. My wife's retiring on 3/1/98, and I planned on going out with her, but I am ineligible to do that now. The legislature in half the state believe that state workers are overpaid and underworked. While this is untrue, and at least from a probation officer's standpoint, it nevertheless boggles my mind that if they believe this, then they're missing the boat. That this is a chance to get rid of some of us people and satisfy everybody. You know, and I think the criteria needs to be revised to let me and other people in my shoes go. I really feel that whatever the criteria used is unfair. And with the cost savings of hiring somebody new to replace me at a lesser wage and a lesser retirement benefits, for me to have to pay $5,000 or the cost to get rid of me at $5,000, I think is dead wrong. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Stalnaker?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, I'd like to clarify a few things, and also for Mr. Bladorn. The Division of Retirement and Benefits doesn't tell anybody they're in the red. I mean, the decision on whether there's a savings or not is made at the employer level. Office of Management and Budget makes that decision for the state. The university finance people make it for the university. The city of Ketchikan makes it for Ketchikan. We just determine what the actuarial cost is. And also, we don't talk to employers about who they can replace with whom. You know, that's well out of our jurisdiction. That's an area we've never wanted to step in, and we don't intend to ever want to step into that. We've got enough to deal with the actuarial costs and so forth. So I don't know who Mr. Bladorn had been talking to, but it, you know, certainly wasn't being directed from our office.
Thank you. Representative Terrio?
Anna Lee or Bob, could you talk about the savings of shifting people to the tier two from the tier one. I mean, it seems like you would pick up some savings there.
That was a good point raised, and it has created a lot of, I think, questions in many people's minds. The assumption is always that the position would be filled by someone who's coming in as a tier three employee, but that's in fact not the case for a couple of reasons. One of which is you might have someone who's worked for the state, let's say, only a year, but if that person worked in local government back when tier one was in place, the person may well be a tier one employee by virtue of other employment that they've had even before the state of Alaska. So we had no way of predicting whether an employee who fills a position will be a tier one, tier two, or tier three employee. When we calculate benefits for the state and deal with overall calculations, also we blend all those three. And it's going to take some time before there are enough tier one employees, for instance, to really change the total picture of the cost of benefits to the state. But it was particularly because of that situation that we have lots of new state employees who have old service that counts, that makes them tier one folks, that we realized we could be very significantly overstating the savings if we made the assumption that everybody would be replaced with a tier three. And that's why we did make that decision. But I realize there are lots of people for whom that, you know, when they first hear it, it doesn't make sense, but that's background on it.
I'd like to go on, and we're going to run out of time to get the people that want to testify, so I'm going to try and get through people. If we can't answer a couple questions, we will, but Mr. Adams, are you available in Kenai? John Adams?
I'm here.
Yeah, if you could, go ahead with your testimony.
Yes, my name is John Adams. I've worked the troopers since 1977. I have a few questions that I would like just to know how they came up with the figure or formula. To the best of my knowledge, no one can figure out what formula was used. I know of troopers who came on at the same time, approximately the same age. One person qualifies for the RIP, the next person doesn't. One of the figures used, if you're a trooper, to figure up, from my understanding, an additional cost, is $36,400, in addition to everything else. If you are a corporal or above in the state troopers, the only additional cost that is used is $3,000. From what I've seen so far, chances of, if you're with the troopers, chances of you making the RIP bill as a corporal or above are mighty slim. If you're a trooper, they're non-existent. I think there's approximately 50 people, 50 troopers, I'm talking specifically just troopers, that are eligible for the RIP. Only four, to the best of my knowledge, qualify. And if it's a deal where if you got 20 years on, you qualify, I can understand that. I just would like to know what continuity was used. That's my only concern. That'll be all.
Thanks. Any?
42, there are 42 trooper positions that have been approved for the RIP. The other part about why some qualify and some don't, again, that's the kind of question that somebody could call Retirement and Benefits and that person could walk you through the differences.
Yeah, and I guess we'd have to see, obviously. I assume overtime plays a part.
Mr. Chairman, I would like to bring out one thing. It seems like some of the references are being made to if a trooper is replaced, there might be additional training costs and so forth, as opposed to a corporal or a sergeant who you generally promote then from the lower ranks, so you wouldn't have. So many of these questions may not be issues that we can help the person with. Certainly they're free to call and we'll see if we can answer their questions, but some of these questions seem to be additional costs that the employer, in this case the state, might be applying in the rationale that they apply as replacement type costs. So I guess just, you know, basically it's, we can help with the actuarial side of things. And the other elements are things they're going to have to deal with their own employer on.
Well, excuse me, I don't know if I'm free to talk again, but my question is if a corporal retires or a sergeant or a lieutenant retires under the RIP bill, everything moves up a notch, and you're going to be getting a trooper basically moving up to that corporal slot. So it's going to have to be replaced anyway. Why is it that there's such a disparity between, you know, $3,000 and $36,400? That's my big question. Because you're going to, bottom line is you're going to have to replace a trooper.
I don't know. Did you want to, Mr. Stallnaker, go again? It sounded to me like what they were saying is when you replace a trooper, particularly with somebody that hasn't been, there's $30,000 or a significant training cost that is incurred by the state versus there is very little training cost for a trooper to move into a corporal's position versus hiring a new trooper who then has to go to the academy, the additional training costs that are involved in that, and that's why there's an additional cost to replace a trooper.
I have offered to go out and meet with departments where there are questions like this, and I would be happy to reiterate that offer because there are different circumstances in different departments. But even if you have, I think these questions are in some cases are fairly specific to individual situations, but I'm between us, OMB yeah. and Retirement Benefits, we certainly have offered a number of times to make ourselves available to groups of employees or doing one-on-one, so I'd be happy to continue that.
Thank you. I'd like to go on and get a few more folks in. Mr. Zorich in Petersburg, Bob Zorich.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. This is Bob Zorich. I retired from Fish and Game Sport Fish Division in October of last year, and I was not considered qualified for the RIP program, but one thing I was liking to find out is we have never been given a list of who qualified in Fish and Game for the RIF, and we were told that it was not public information. And I guess the reason I'm interested in is how many people were in the supervisory unit versus the general government unit that were actually given the RIF compared to people that were potentially qualified in the beginning. And another thing is I do know some people were also upgraded, or I shouldn't say upgraded, but moved from the general government unit into the supervisory's unit just before receiving the RIF. That enabled them to also cash out sick leave as personal leave at about a 40% rate. Why was that offered to certain individuals and not? I think there's some disparity in our department about how people qualify. I was told I did not qualify because they were not going to downgrade my position or eliminate it. Well, and so I decided to retire. I found out that, well, my position still isn't filled. They may not fill it until July of this coming year. And I heard recently that they're going to fill it as an FD2 now instead of an FD3, a whole step or range down. And yet they told me I wasn't qualified for the RIF. There's another person out of Wrangell that can't testify today because he's on medical leave. But they've been threatening to eliminate his position there in Wrangell for the last 10 years because of budget cuts. In 6 months, he's going to qualify for retirement, and they say he doesn't qualify for the RIF. And yet, for 10 years, they've been threatening to cut his position. That's all I have to say.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Zorich. Is Steve Hansen there?
Yes, he is.
Okay. Yes, thank you. My name is Steve Hansen in Petersburg. I'm in the Alaska Department of Fish and Game. First of all, I'd like to say that there's obviously been a lot of thought that has gone into this on behalf of your team up there and the Office of Management and Budget. And one of the things I'd like to say or commend is that this period is a three-year window. I've been with the state for approximately 19 years and have gone through several setbacks in funding that I've faced layoff two times myself. And during the period that a RIF was not available, we had people that had at least 17 years of service in who faced layoff, and their only choice in that matter was to, through the state bumping process, bump and displace people at a lower level who were not eligible for a RIF. And basically, a lot of our expertise and our future management people dropped out the bottom of the system in that case. So I'd like to encourage that, to the extent that layoffs do occur in the future, that we have consideration for that from the standpoint that people that may be eligible to go otherwise go but are not given that choice end up displacing people that drop out the lower end. that the state already has invested a lot of time and money in training for our mid-level managers. The other thing that I just want to bring up is, as Curtis and I understand the difficulties, when the lady from Office of Management Budget talked about the trickle-down effects of who may replace who, but I offer that, you know, it may work inversely to costing more if we look at a range 18 being replaced by somebody that was a 16. That person that was a 16, if his position is replaced, may well be somebody that was a 14. So this could go down several levels throughout the system. So again, I want to thank you for your time and look forward to what your hearing resolves. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Hansen. I'd like to go to Kodiak and Bill Donaldson.
Thank you. My name is Bill Donaldson. I've been employed with ADF&G as a shellfish research biologist for 23-plus years. During the last 10 years, I found it to be increasingly difficult to meet the objectives of my research program due to decreasing state general funds. My current general fund operational budget, excluding my salary, has averaged about $15,000 per annum. This meager sum is meant to cover shellfish research for the entire Gulf of Alaska. And as a result of the budget deficit, I have invested much time and energy in grant writing and cooperative research efforts with other agencies. Since 91, I, along with my co-investigators, have added about $600,000 to Gulf of Alaska shellfish research through the receipt of grants. This grantmanship was not directed or encouraged by AF&G and is solely the effort of myself and colleagues to bring the budget gap, to bridge the budget gap and conduct a viable program. My professional experience has shown me that the department needs to encourage this kind of activity and to exercise every opportunity to realize cost savings that can be redirected to programs. One way to do this is with the RIP program. I am amazed that the department has chosen a very narrow focus by offering the RIP to only those employees in positions to be downgraded or eliminated. A list compiled by the Commercial Fisheries Management Development Division showed that a cost savings of $175,000 would be saved per annum if employees who show a cost savings took advantage of the RIP. If only half of those eligible participated, the cost savings would be about six times the dollar amount of my operational budget. At a recent staff meeting held here in Kodiak, Fish and Game staff were encouraged to lobby the legislature on budget issues. I wonder how we can be asked to pursue this line of fundraising when it is obvious that we, as a department, are not exercising every opportunity at our disposal to save money. I believe the legislature should encourage the department to take every opportunity provided to save dollars as well as generate dollars, and I think this RIP opportunity is one of those I have highlighted. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Donaldson. Is John Logan there?
Yes, sir.
Yeah, go ahead with your testimony.
Yeah, thanks. I'm working for the city of Kodiak, and I've been with them 4 years. Before that, I worked for the state of Alaska years back, so I'm under the Tier 1 also. It seems like the way this RIP program is set up, any virtually new hires or new upgrades are the ones that don't qualify. If you've just been promoted, why, then you don't show a savings because you don't go down to any lower grades and the grades be getting raised up. Anyway, the whole ticket seems really unfair. Here for the city of Kodiak, there was 28 of us supposedly that did originally qualify, but because of cost savings, it ended up there was five of us that couldn't participate, and I ended up being the only one that was denied the chance to get in on this. I'm 63 years old, and I got 22 years in on the PERS system. I'm not allowed to take this, but because of the cost savings issue, why they say no, and it seems like as a political subdivision rather than the state employee, why we don't have as much say in what's going on. The city is pretty much holding the line. Well, this is the way the bill's written, and this is the way we're going to do it. Although one of the five that didn't qualify because the savings didn't didn't get a chance to participate for some reason or other, and I'm not sure why that happened yet. Anyway, I just think the whole thing, the way it's written up, is pretty unfair. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Logan. Go to Lou Wood in Fairbanks. Okay, nobody left in Fairbanks? Okay, how about Jim Allen in Anchorage?
Yes, this is Jim Allen. Thank you very much for the opportunity to speak. I'm an employee of the North Slope Borough and have been in the FERS system for approximately 12 years. It seems to me that the intent of the bill was to promote savings to the state of Alaska. In order to do that, the employer, it seems reasonable that the employer needs to look at every opportunity to find ways of saving through this RIP program. Therefore, it seems that the employer should look at each individual case on the merits of that case. Unfortunately, it doesn't seem to me that the North Slope Borough has chosen to do that. And I believe that, from what I've heard earlier, that state employees are being examined on a case-by-case basis, specifically if the position is going to be vacated or reclassified. I believe I fall in that position where if I were retired, that the position would either be vacated or reclassified, and if those figures were applied to the formula, that in fact I would then be ineligible. So it sounds to me like a number of the people speaking fall into a similar category where rigid system of application is not taking into consideration all of the factors affecting the position, and therefore people are being eliminated and cost savings are being lost to the state. And so my point is that I think that the various employers need to be encouraged to look at individual cases and to make every effort to find that savings that's available through this RIP program. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Allen. Annalee, I'm going to have a couple people come up to the table here pretty quick. If maybe I'll go one more on the teleconference, and then we can go to, let's see who's next. Diana Crane.
North Slope Borough Personnel Department. And I guess my only question is, and after listening to some of this public input, is there a possibility that there will be an amendment to this bill? And if so, what kind of impact will there be for employers to revisit the RIP bill?
This is Mark Hanley. I don't know if there will be. Nobody's proposed one yet. One of the things we're getting out is information right now. It was tough enough to get a RIP bill through last time, and a lot of people still, frankly, in the legislature are skeptical of the kinds of savings, and I think that's one of the reasons the department's being very cautious on how they count their savings as to whether there are any. There isn't a bill that I know of now making changes. One of the things that we had this hearing for is to try and find out the concerns that people have, see if there is an attempt or a need to clarify things, and if so, what those things are. So at this point, no, there isn't one, and I wouldn't know until after this meeting and maybe some more discussions as to whether that will occur.
Thank you.
Sure. Is Carolyn Anderson there?
Yes.
So my name is Carolyn Anderson. Thank you for the opportunity to speak. I'm in Barrow, and I work for the Northland Borough. I also agree with Mr. Christensen in that I believe it would be more advantageous if the bill covered a five-year period instead of three. Another place to look at would be the 5% salary increase that you build into your formula. I don't know about the rest of Alaska, but that didn't happen here. And so the formula then that was developed here on the slope doesn't match the state formula. Also, another reason the five-year plan would be more likely to benefit and meet the spirit of the legislation for the North Slope Borough is that we had a lot of changes made in 95 to the entry-level wages for a number of positions that were on the books at a figure too low to be real. At the same time, people were earning a higher salary, okay, for the same position that was on the books at a lower cost. They reevaluated and adjusted those. So the entry-level wage was now much higher and closer to the actual salary. Therefore, you have a very narrow band to show any savings. So for us to take advantage of the law here, I believe we need a five-year window to average with. I think that was all that I had to say, except to note that I believe the borough would like to participate more fully since it would let younger people in. But this can't happen if we're not eligible. We're also interested in anything that would let us apply as individuals. I am not in the personnel department or part of the very small group that designed the formula. It's almost an uphill struggle to try and understand the benefits or how to weight or tell you to improve the formula. In addition, there have been many errors put forth by both the state and locally. They have added real confusion and even some elements of fear that because we don't understand how these figures are put together, have we been looked over because we're just ignorant? I once received a letter here saying that I was eligible.